Let's play some cards.
I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please.
This is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and professional broadcaster Paul Harris.
You're good, kid. But as long as I'm around, you're second best. You might as well learn to live with it.
You got to know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em.
Now, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com.
And we are coming to you today from the Rio in Las Vegas for our opening coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker in person. Last week, we told you a little bit about some of the things that happened in the first couple of days, including Dennis playing in the first $1,500 buy-in no-limit hold'em event. But a lot has gone on here in the last week, and we are here to report on it. Hi, I am Paul Harris, sitting with professional poker player Dennis Phillips inside our own little media row. We made our own media row at the World Series of Poker at the Rio. Right around the corner, by the way, from the Image Masters photo booth, where a lot of people are coming by and getting their pictures taken.
It is. It's kind of cool to be able to capture, say that, as they say, capture the moment. That if you come out here, you play in one of these events, you do it, and they've done a couple of cool things now. That you can get your name written across it. You can get a participant. You can get it nice and framed up. You can get a collage of three or four pictures of you playing with different variety of stacks. The gal that I talked to her this morning that finished second in the first event out here, the employees event,
yes,
which she said she's played 6 years in a row, never even cashed before, and then she came in second. She was just tickled to death.
Yeah.
But she made a nice little collage of three pictures, two of them showing her at the final table with her stack getting bigger and bigger, you know, type deal, and then beneath it has her name and second place finish for event number one and all that. It's kind of cool. So just someplace, you know, nice little gift for somebody maybe or something.
That is pretty cool, and there are several other vendors out here as well along that big hallway that goes by the Pavilion and Amazon and Brasilia rooms. Now, I mentioned the three rooms because I find, and I've been coming to the World Series here for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, I find the energy level seems way down this year. I think I know the answer, and I think it is because they have put people in the Brasilia room to start every noon tournament. The Pavilion room, which used to have a lot of that starting action, is still the home of the deep stack events and the sit-and-goes and the nearly 100 tables of cash games that are going on here. And the Amazon room is where you move to day two of any event and where all the final tables are being played. But I think the fact that they've moved the start of the big tournaments into the Brasilia room has spread things out to the point where the energy level, to me, seems lower. How about for you?
I agree with you 100%. In fact, I talked to Ty Stewart about that. We were just kind of sitting around here, you know, after a few days into this, what's the pluses, what's the minuses. That they did this, and I actually agreed with her philosophy behind it, and I thought it was going to be a good idea. They did it for the players. They wanted to pull the players out, the tournament players, so that they're not hearing announcements that, you know, opening's now at the 2-5 table and, you know, all this other stuff that's always blaring across there. And it's just kind of segregating and it sounded like a really good idea. But the problem you have now is instead of walking in there and you see a massive amount of tables with people sitting at all of them and, you know, remember the problems they had last year. They had times where they were so jammed packed, especially with that deep stack tournament that they had in the afternoon, which was getting over 1,000 people a lot of days,
yep,
that they would go over the sit-and-goes and say, sorry, there's going to be no sit-and-goes till 5 p.m. or some such
thing. Or the same with the cash games.
Cash games, they would shut them way down and then just started opening those up as tables became available as people busted out.
Yep.
So they expanded it. Great. They went from just under 400 tables to almost 500 tables. Great. They've now got it spread out in three different rooms. Great. Lots of elbow room. You just don't have the atmosphere.
Yep. You don't have the atmosphere because you don't have all the people in the same place. And I do understand how it can get overcrowded, and it did, particularly on a Saturday when you had a 1K or a 1,500 and you had a couple of thousand people playing that day. But I think that one change they should already be thinking about, and maybe they can't do it for this year, but certainly for next year, is keep all that stuff in the Pavilion room and have Brasilia as your overflow room. So if your tournament that's starting out in there would normally encroach on the sit-and-goes or the deep stacks or the cash games, put the extra new people Mm-hmm. Past a certain registration point, put them in Brasilia. That way you see the sea of humanity. Because I have a friend who came out here, it's his first year at the WSOP, and he's heard me talk about this sea of poker players.
Yep.
You walk into a room where there are 2,000 people playing the same game as you, maybe not the same stakes, but they're all playing poker in the same room you are. That gives you a rush.
Yeah,
didn't
it does.
Didn't you feel that when you came out here in 08? 100%.
It absolutely does. It's not attention. That's not the right word. But it's the atmosphere. It's the excitement. It's the adrenaline flow. You just walk in there and you literally start at one end of the pavilion room and you're walking all the way to the other to get to your table. And you almost start bouncing as you get about halfway there because you just the adrenaline rush is coming. You're looking at table after table after table after table.
Right.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
And
so,
you know,
I think that that's definitely affecting the energy level, as is the fact that they're not getting the fields that they thought they would. Donnie Peters, who is the guy in charge of all the correspondence for Poker News, which is the official site covering this, not just for PokerNews.com, but also on WSOP.com, they've got, I don't know, 36 people out here covering this event. He's going to join us later on, and we're going to talk to him about some of the big stories of the first week of the WSOP. But it seems to me like they're having a problem with turnout. Maybe it's because of the different events that they had in the first week and not so many No Limit Hold'em events.
Well, that and some of the events they had in the first week here were the brand-new events, and they're a little bit different. When you have an event where you start with a full ring, you go to six max, and you go to heads up. Never been done here before. They did it in Europe one time, was successful. But, again, it's a little bit different.
The mixed max 5K event.
Absolutely. Just the variety of it. What was the other one?
$3,000 buy-in, No Limit Hold'em, Pot Limit Omaha event.
There you go. Another.
Heads up.
Heads up. Totally different again for it. They were hoping to sell that one out. They did not. They didn't even come close. They had 516, I think, for the max. They only got 300 and some.
Yeah.
So an awful lot of people got a buy on the first round.
Now, I will say that the Omaha High-Low event that was played here on Friday had, more people than it did last year. Once again, the biggest Omaha 8 event in the world was here at the World Series because it was bigger than last year. And a couple of the other events did surpass the previous years. But
even something like their Pot Limit Hold'em brings out a different strategy, and maybe people aren't comfortable because you just don't see that anywhere else.
Right.
So maybe that affects the number of people. And maybe if that particular event was being held in the third or fourth week, it might make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of them suffered this week, and I'm hoping it will start gathering steam and start increasing the fields.
Now, because you and I have been working on various things and recording interviews that are going to be on the Final Table show over the course of the rest of June, you'll hear some of the great, great stars of poker that we have had a chance to sit down and talk with over the last few days. We're going to run those interviews for you throughout the month of June here on the Final Table Poker Show. You and I haven't really been able to play many tournaments. I think the only other one that you and I played in was the one this weekend, event number 9, which was the re-entry event,
correct.
$1,500 buy-in.
Correct.
And neither of us are playing day 2.
No. I made it to about the dinner break. I did start with a $4,500. Chip got up over $10,000. But again, you're so short-stacked. All it takes is a couple of hands to bleed you down. I had a king-jack suited on a jack-high flop, back and forth, lost some chips. The guy had pocket queens. Okay, sorry. I had king-jack to an ace-jack. Again, jack-high flop. I lost some more chips. You know, I didn't play it badly. He didn't play it badly. Neither of us got, ridiculous. But, you lose a couple of thousand on each of those hands. All of a sudden, you're back to starting chips. There you go.
Yep.
I got it in. Again, guy didn't, no bad beats, no nothing like that. I raised with pocket tens. Guy in the big blind shoves for a short stack. I call. I'm hoping for a raise of this thing, or maybe I've got him dominated if he's got nines or eights. He turns over ace jack. I've got pocket tens. Last card out, the river card is a jack. But it's not a bad play. If I had his stack, I probably would have shoved there too.
Mm-hmm.
So, nothing to complain about. It just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And
you lasted longer than I did.
Okay.
After being absolutely card dead in the first 90 minutes. I played 3 hands in the first 90 minutes. Finally, I pick up pocket kings. And a guy in middle position, a good player. He's been involved in a few pots now, so he's got a bit of a stack. He raises. comes around to me with pocket kings, and I three bet.
Yeah.
He's eyeing me as it folds back around to him, and he four bets it. Not a min raise, but just a little bit more, maybe like a 2.25 raise. And I think to myself, okay, if I raise here, if I just min raise, five bet min raise here, I'm going to send a signal. Because it's going to be half my stack that's involved
in
this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I do exactly that. I don't put them all in. Because I'm actually thinking to myself, I will lay these kings down if he shoves. I'm going to save the other half of my stack here. If he six bet shoves on me, I'm going to lay it down. And so I just min raise. And he just calls. And I think, okay, he has queens.
Mm-hmm.
Flop comes queen high. He shoves. And I look at him, and I'm getting a good read on the guy,
yep,
who's not giving off anything, by the way. He has to have... There's only two hands he has there, queens or aces.
Yeah.
Maybe he does that with jacks, but I don't think he insta-shoves on a queen high flop. He loves it. I could tell he's giving off something positive, and so I lay down my kings, and so that's half my stack. So on the next hand, it's folded around to me, and I'm in the cutoff. And I look down at ace-queen, and I shove 41 big blinds. I open shove 41 big blinds. The button folds, the small blind folds, the big blind looks over at me, looks at his cards again, and calls with ace-jack.
He what?
He calls 41 big blinds with ace-jack, obviously thinking, I'm steaming. Now, the reason I shoved there, by the way, was, well, twofold. One, I'm not going to play for another 6 hours with a small stack here and end up not going anywhere. I got better things to do than I can go. I'll give up my $1,500 and I'll go get it back somewhere else. That's
right.
My attitude at this point. I also, the reason I'm shoving those 41 big blinds is I want people to think I'm steaming from the previous hand when I obviously had aces or kings. And I had to lay it down when the guy flopped a set of queens. I want him to think I'm steaming and call me light. I want this guy to call me with ace-jack in that situation. Mm-hmm. I don't want the jack on the turn. And I'm not telling it it's a bad beat story just because we're talking about our experiences.
Yeah.
And that was the end of my experience.
Yeah.
Now, the good part of it for me was I then left, had some lunch, and went off to play in the single-table satellites, which I played a little bit in the past, but you have talked about it so much, both on the air and off the air, that I said, you know what, I'm going to go and spend the rest of the day grinding these things the way Dennis has in the past. Wasn't there one year where you played more than a dozen?
I know one year I played 19 of them, and I either won or chopped 13 of them. And I've done that a couple of different years. They are just... really, really nice.
They have them at different levels: $175 buy-in, a $275,
right,
a 3.25, a 5.25, and a 1080.
Yep.
Most of the people playing the 1080 are looking at that as if you win the table, you're in the main event, and that's what they're doing it for. I'm not looking at it that I want to get tournament chips. I'm looking at it as I'm going to win and make money, which I have done once or twice in the past. So I enter my first one, and I'm the first one out on a bad beat. Fine, okay, but that's the way these things go. I then play four more over the course of the next 2 days and win the first of those four and chop the other three.
Sweet.
So,
there you go.
So I've more than made up for the
$1,500
that I lost in my 90 minutes of bracelet tournament play.
Yeah.
But the sit-and-goes are very juicy. Now let's talk about that because we've kind of teased it on the show a couple of times.
Yep.
There is a certain strategy to playing these, both from the beginning, in the beginning part, in the middle, and certainly at the end when you get down to the last two or three players. Share your thoughts on sit-and-go strategy for people who may be coming out here and can't afford to play $1,000 or $1,500. This is a way to build your bankroll a little bit.
Again, I like all the levels of it, and the blind structure is set up, and the levels are set up that if you get up to the 3 or the 500, you've got a decent amount of time to play it. They're pretty much a shove fest when you do those $65 ones and the $120 ones.
I will tell you that when you, they don't have 65s here this year. The 175 is the smallest. And those are 1,500 chips with 15-minute blind levels.
Yeah.
If you play the 275 or the 3.25, it's 1,500 in chips with 20-minute levels, but the first blind start at 25-25 instead of 25-50.
Right.
So you really get to go through maybe about three rounds before you're an hour to an hour 20 before it becomes a shove fest for all the short stacks.
Yeah. I like the 500 one the best of all of them. Gives you a little bit more play, gives you a little bit better starting stack. The $1,000 one, you run into an awful lot of pros.
Yeah.
I've sat down there, and I've played with Jonathan Little, and I've played with several of these other guys that like to grind out the sit-and-goes. A little tougher competition there. A little better reward, too. I'll see who's sitting at a $1,000 one before I'll just automatically buy into that.
Yep.
But any $300 to $500 range one, I would be in a heartbeat.
The ones that I played over the last few days are the 275s and the 3 1/4s.
That's good.
Only because the 5 1/4s weren't going at the time. And I like those. I like the skill level, let's call it, of the opponents at the 275 and 325 level.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but when I sit down there, without even before any other player sits down, I know from experience half the table is going to blow out in the first half hour.
They always do. It's amazing. They sit down with some people have different ideas here. One of the ideas that they have is, I've got to get chips quick. I don't know why they do that. It's just not that much pressure. You've got a decent amount of chips in front of you. You don't have to. You can sit back. So you try and identify those guys that are being just uber aggressive and trying to grab chips no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a little gentle note. You know how they're playing, the whole bit like that.
You know, I've played a lot of these sit-and-goes. I have never seen somebody go wire-to-wire as chip leader to winner from early on. Somebody who wins a lot of chips early on, they are never the last person sitting there.
It's extremely rare. That's for sure. The guy that doubles up or triples up at the beginning, somehow or other, just can't put the anchor out, can't slow down.
Right.
That's what they ought to do.
Exactly.
I've got chips. I don't have to do anything. I should go, you know, eat a sandwich for the next half hour is what they should do. But they never do.
No.
They never
do. Keep putting the pressure on, and the chip stack goes away.
Now, I say the real poker starts when you get down to four, five, or six people.
Yep.
Because by then, you've eliminated the three or four people. You've got to be a little careful, because if you just totally knit it up and you go down to the five or six people and you haven't won hardly any hands and you just got starting chips or even a little less in front of you, you're almost at the level where you have to do, you know, a shove or fold type. That's not good. I like to at least have 50% more chips. If you're starting out with 2,000, you need to be up to the 3,000 level, kind of that thing, to give you a little bit of playing so you can, you know, make a stab at a pot, so you can limp in if you need to, so you can do whatever.
Speaking of limping, I'm shocked at the number of people who limp fold in sit-and-go tournaments.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have that many chips to begin with.
Correct.
Every single chip is too valuable to limp fold. I never limp in these things unless I've got somebody ultra-aggressive who I know I'm going to be able to re-raise once he raises behind me. Otherwise, I'm always opening or folding.
I do it a little bit different because I play the position at the end, and if I've got two or three people in and I've got some oddball hand, I don't want to limp there with ace jack. I don't want to do that. But if I've got a 6-4 of hearts in late position with three limpers ahead of me, I want to see a flop.
Oh, if I have 6-4 of hearts and I got three limpers ahead of me, I'm all in.
Okay.
I'm going to take those flop chips. As far as I'm concerned, when you limp, you're announcing the table, I'm adding dead money to the pot.
Okay, well, again, different way to do it. I'm looking for one of the monsters to take out these idiots. Okay, and if I catch, you know, two fours, they're never going to put me on a four. Or if I catch that weird straight or, you know, whatever type deal, they're never going to put you on that. And you're sitting in late position, they make the mistakes first.
Yeah.
I love it because
True.
That's a great way to chip up.
True.
Your way takes it down. I'm in a cash game, I'm playing a little different.
No, I'm not talking about cash game. This is specifically sit-and-go strategy. You're starting with 1,500 in chips.
Yeah.
How can you possibly limp fold at 5,100?
Yeah.
You do that three times, that's a 20% of your stack.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to do that. And you'll see people do it. I have seen people in these sit-and-goes call a raise for 60% of their chips and then fold. And you look at them and go, what two cards could you possibly have and do that?
Yeah.
But you see it all the time.
I don't get it.
No, I don't understand that either. So, you know, getting to the middle is usually fairly easy. I almost, unless it's a bad beat, which happens.
Yep.
You know, I mean, sometimes you just can't control it.
Right.
You know, and it happens. And
Ace King does not always beat Ace Queen.
Yeah.
Kings do not always beat Queens.
Yep.
Right.
It just happens. But barring that, I almost never am one of the first three or four people out of the leagues. You're always sitting there, and you're down to the five-handed, and then the real poker starts.
Correct.
By then, hopefully you've played enough that you can identify the players and how they play and pick up a tell or two, you know. Then you can start playing your position. Then you can start playing.
Yep.
And it makes a huge difference.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. The other thing, the last thing I'll say is that when I get down to heads up or three-handed, even depending on the quality of players I have there, I have absolutely no problem chopping. I will chop unless I feel I have a really dominant edge.
Mm-hmm. Will you chop three-handed or wait till you get to two?
Depends on the players. Most of the time it's two, but if they're two good quality players and there's nobody with real dominant chips or something like that, or they give me a very good deal, which I've had a couple of times, they literally don't want to play heads up with me or anything. I have 20% of the chips. You're going to give me 40% of the money?
Mm-hmm.
Done.
See,
you know.
Now, I'll tell you about one of the chops that I made the other day. There were three of us left, and one guy took out the other guy.
Okay.
So now he had 11,300, and I had 3,700. Because there's 1,500 you start, there's 10 players, so 15,000 altogether.
Right.
I have 3,700, mm-hmm. which is about a quarter of the chips.
Yeah.
Now, let me just pause my story for just a second, because we didn't talk about another part of sit and goes, which are last longers.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'll just say that in this particular game, there was $1,000 in last longers in addition to the $2,600 in prize money. It was a $275, and the prize money is for one winner, $2,610, nothing for anybody else,
yeah.
unless you end up chopping it. So in ours, our prize pool was $3,610.
Yep.
So when we got to heads up and he has 75% of the chips, I said, what do you want to do? I never make the first offer. I always am the guy who says, what do you want to do? Let them make the first offer.
That's nice if it works, but a lot of times I end up making the first offer.
You do?
I do. Because they'll say, oh, you're more experienced than I am. How do you want to do this?
It sucks being famous.
But anyhow, I have no problem making the first offer.
So anyway, I have 25% of the chips, and he says, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you take the 1,000 in last longer money, and I'll take the 2,600. So I do some quick math, and I realize I've got 25% of the chips, and he's offering me 40% of the money.
Exactly. Where do I sign?
No, I don't say that immediately, because I know in the first offer situation, there's often negotiating that can go on there.
Not with me. I make an offer, it's an offer.
Okay, well, I'm going to try for some wiggle room there.
Okay.
So I said, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you give me $1,500 and I'll go away. And I say it exactly like that. Like, you know, $1,500, fine, we're done if it's $1,500. And he says, no, let's play. And I say, okay, fine. So for the next four hands, we trade the small blind back and forth. Nobody raises the button. Nobody limps the button. We just trade it back and forth. And on the fifth hand, I double up. Well,
ooh,
3,700,
okay.
And 3,700 is 7,400. He now has 7,600. I have 7,400. And I say, what do you want to do? He said, you want to chop it? I said, done. So instead of 1,000, I ended up with 1,800.
Okay.
Worked out better for me. I almost never accept the first offer. I always think there's some wiggle room. And if they do want to play it out, okay, we can play it out. But sometimes you chip up and things change, and that's exactly what happened. Now let me go back to talking about the last longers. Usually when you sit down at these, here at the Rio, during the World Series of Poker, this is not everywhere, but here, if you play in a 275 or a 375, there'll be people who want to get involved in a last longer for another $100. Now, that money, the casino takes no piece of.
Correct.
And I will say that the rake on these sit-and-goes are, I think, the best deal you can get.
They're good.
Because you know how much they take out of 3.25? They take $13. That's 4%.
Yeah.
Where else in the poker world is there a 4% rake? That's pretty good. Plus, now you have this last longer money, which has a 0% rake. And usually, the last longer will involve 3, 4, maybe 5 people at the table, so you don't even have to win it to necessarily win the last longer money if you can knock out the other people involved in the last longer. I have, however, been at tables with 7, 8, 9, or even 10 people involved in the last longer, and that's essentially just adding money to the prize pool, and that's fine too. But the fact that it's rake-free makes it worthwhile, and so when you're going to enter a 275, think of it as a 375.
Yep.
That's really what you want to buy in for, to get an edge, if you can afford it. If you can't afford it and you only want to play a 175 and don't want to play any last longers, that's fine too. But it's just another way to get a little bit more money in there. And if you're a good player, you have an edge on the house and you have an edge on the table.
Yeah, I don't like heads up last longers very much.
I don't either.
If you can have four or more people at the table, I'm in for any amount usually. It doesn't make any difference. And I played $1,000 last longers on a $1,000 tournament. We did that here a couple of times last year.
Yep.
Which means your prize pool has effectively doubled.
Yep.
So, you know, those are pretty sweet.
Which cuts your rake in half.
There you go.
Yeah. Right. When I played one of the 3 1/4s, a guy wanted to do a heads up, and I said, well, I don't want to do a heads up. If somebody else wants to get in on it, well, you know, we can do it. And so a third guy got in, and since we only had 3 of them, I said, you want to make it 200 instead of 100? Okay.
Yeah.
Now you got something to play for.
Right. Yeah, it's easy way to, and it does go the other way. If you're in a 175 and everybody only wants to put $20 in,
that's
for
fine.
That, you know, if that's what the table agrees to, it's no problem.
Yeah.
You know, it still makes a nice little bonus over there. And it also gives you chop value when you get down to 2 or 3 hand, if you got that extra money in there to do it.
Yep.
So it works out well.
I've been in situations where you got down to 3-handed and all 3 people were still in the last longer. Maybe there's 9 people who were in originally, and now there's 900 in there. And when it gets down to 3, somebody will say, why don't we chop the last longer so we get our $300 back? So we're kind of free-rolling for the rest of this.
There you go.
That's a good idea also.
I love it. Yeah, things like that I'll do almost any time.
I've been at a table where 9 people were in the last longer, and one guy doesn't want to do it. And I say, sir, it's absolutely fine. And I'm going to tell you right now, every hand you're in that I'm not in, I'm rooting for you.
Absolutely. You are now the favorite person on the table for 9 other people.
So I don't think we had talked about the sit-and-go strategy. Yeah. And it doesn't go everywhere. But certainly when you come out here to the Rio, people have pockets full of cash. They like playing these things. They're not necessarily very good players. And I think there's real value in them. In fact, as soon as we're done with today's show, I'm going right back to that.
Well, a couple of other points we kind of touched upon. One of the other reasons that I like doing the chopping and everything is the simple fact that I want to get in another sit and go.
Right.
I don't want to play heads up with a guy for an hour.
Right.
Sorry, it's just, you know, it consumes too much of your time for too little of your return.
And by the way, you can have 75% of the chips, double the other guy up, and you're back to even.
Yeah.
You could have 80% of the chips, double the guy up twice, and it goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's real simple, and heads up is so volatile. So give me a solid deal. I'm not going to let somebody take advantage of them. Give me a solid deal. When you get down to two-handed, I'll take it every time and just go play it so I can get in another one.
Me too.
Not a problem with that.
Don't get stubborn. Oh, I'm better than you, and I can beat you at this.
Yeah,
If you've ever played poker, you know that's not going to always work out for you.
So an hour and a half later, you're still playing against this guy, and you know, you've lost
an opportunity. Or 3 hands go by, and he's doubled up 3 times, and you're done.
Who knows? Yeah, it could be all sorts of things.
Yeah.
The other thing that makes a little bit different, and I think one of the reasons why they can have less rake there, is that the money is paid out at the table with the dealer still there. You have one dealer for the entire sit and go.
Yes.
And then the tips are there, and you know, the percentage of people that will tip the dealer is way bigger than you get in any regular tournament or anything like
yes.
that. So that 3% that they pull out for the dealers in a lot of tournaments or whatever it happens to be, they don't have to take there. They know the players are going to take care of the dealer.
Right.
And I always do take care of the dealer.
Absolutely. If you play a $325 tournament and you win it and there's 31.60 or 31.20 in the prize pool. Yeah, 31.20 is what it would enter. Give $100 to the dealer.
Exactly.
Give the $120 in cash to the dealer.
Yeah.
They're going to give you tournament chips that you can then sell to people who are buying in or use yourself to buy in to any of the other tournaments here. But, yeah, be generous with the dealers.
Absolutely. There's no reason not to. That's why a lot of the dealers really like going down there, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But pays out well for them, pays out well for you. I see no downside.
A couple of other things before we bring in Donnie Peters to talk about the news of this first week of the WSOP. Jean-Robert Ballande just tweeted, look at this. He has an announcement coming this afternoon about the one drop. That's the million-dollar buy-in event. Is somebody going to bankroll JRB in the million-dollar buy-in event, Dennis?
I suppose anything is possible. how do I politely say this? No offense to him, but if I had to pick a poker player out that I was going to bankroll for $1 million into a tournament, not him. He's a good player.
Enough said.
In a cash game, he's much better. In a mixed game, he's much better. In a no-limit tournament like that,
Now, he did run into the top 100 last year.
Oh, I'm not arguing event. That. Yeah. So did 99 other people.
All right. One final story. Over the weekend, we were invited. I went. Dennis had other things to do. To a party at Vanessa Russo's party house, which has three other really talented female poker players living in it. Maria Ho, Vanessa Selbst, and Liv Boree. I'm going to tell you, when four attractive young poker players are having a party and I'm invited, I'm going. The party actually started in the afternoon. I didn't get there till the early evening. But when I got there, the party was in full swing. Scott Seaver and Jennifer Harmon and Jonathan Duhamel were involved in a beer pong match on the ping pong table. There's also a pool table there and a half basketball court and a beach volleyball court and a pool and a hot tub and various other rooms and, of course, lots of booze and some food, too. And also some injuries that sent people to the ER. Did you hear about this?
No.
Apparently, Jason Kuhn, who's a poker pro, was trying to teach Liv Boree how to do a backflip, a standing backflip. And she did it and landed on her feet and fractured her ankle. She has a spiral fracture on one of her ankles. Not only that, another guy broke his arm playing basketball on the court. He happens to be the brother of Kevin McPhee, who happens to be Liv's boyfriend. So Kevin McPhee was on the ER run from this party. Tiffany Michelle partially severed a finger. Two other people got hurt at this thing. I mean, it was a huge blowout. There were a lot of people at this party. Vanessa, this is her new house. She didn't buy this as like the summer house. She bought a beautiful new house about a half hour off the strip in North Las Vegas. It's a really, really beautiful place, and I can't believe all the stuff she has on her property. It was a dangerous place to be for that Friday evening.
No, I hadn't heard anything about this. So, in other words, maybe I'm glad I didn't go. I don't know.
Maybe. I stayed about 90 minutes, and I got out of there. I said hi to Vanessa Russo and Maria Ho, and talked with Phil Collins and a couple of other poker pros who were there. I watched the beer pong match. And then I got the heck out of there. And now we've got to get the heck out of here as well. When we come back, Donnie Peters, who's running the coverage of the WSOP for Poker News, will join us as we cover our first week of the World Series of Poker 2012 here at the Rio. With Dennis Phillips, I'm Paul Harris on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And don't forget our podcast available on our new website, FinalTableShow.com, and you can subscribe and download our podcast also via iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Joining us now for our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker is Donnie Peters, who is the live reporting manager and senior writer at Poker News. The last time Donnie and I sat at the same table was last year at the NBC Heads Up. It wasn't actually in the tournament, but next door in the Caesars Palace cash game room, where we sat down in a rather wild 1-3 no-limit game. I think the table had Jason Mercier, Joe Hashem, Chris Moneymaker, Jason Alexander, and a few other guys.
Yes, and Scott Lazar was there.
Yes.
I remember.
Yeah, it was. And I actually got into a bad beat jackpot with Eric Morris from Bluff Magazine, which Donnie and everybody else at the table, well, not everybody else at the table shared in it. Mercier and Moneymaker were away from the table, which somehow made that sweeter, didn't it?
It did make it very sweeter.
Yeah. Now,
I don't know what the odds are that that table comes together and that we hit the bad beat jackpot. You know, out of all tables, we hit the bad beat jackpot.
Unfortunately,
which is pretty crazy.
At Caesars, it's capped at 10K. So, yeah. But anyway, Donnie's now here overseeing coverage of the WSOP for Poker News, which, in addition to posting stuff on its own site, is also providing updates for the official WSOP.com site as well. So, Donnie, welcome back to the final table.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We want to talk to you about some of the big stories of the first week of this 2012 WSOP, and one of them is something that I thought would possibly help you guys, which is this chip tick technology that Dennis explained on last week's show.
Hopefully, right.
Where the D dealers were all going to have kind of like a little iPad-like thing at their table to check players in and update chip counts and that sort of stuff, which I guess would have helped you with information for the site. What happened to ChipTick?
I'm actually not sure what happened. I was going to check on that today. As of last night, I tried to do some digging around, and nobody could kind of give me a finite answer of what went wrong with it. I know that they were going to put it into play last week, Wednesday. They did put it into play for the 1500 Pot Limit Hold'em, and it only lasted about three levels, and then they just scrapped it. I don't know if the dealers didn't know how to handle it or whatnot. I don't know if I know it runs on the internet, and the internet in the Rio can go down once in a while. And if it goes down for 5 minutes, ChipTick is done for that tournament.
Wow.
Yeah, because if you miss, the way it was explained to me is that if the internet goes out and, you know, say Dennis moves tables, if they don't record that, then everything's screwed up in the whole system.
Mm.
So if you miss, you know, a few bust outs or a few people moving tables, everything's out of order, and, you know, then it can just go sour.
Well, that didn't make logical sense to me, because I would think they'd be able to play catch up or something like that, or they could start it at day two, or they could do all sorts of different ways with it. But again, it's a new system. It's a great idea. I hope they get it implemented. But right now, then, I got a question for you. How hard is it, and how do you follow the players without that kind of a crutch? How do you keep the updates online?
Well, for the day ones, we normally just focus on the notable players, the chip leaders, the faces we recognize. Between our team, we can cover a good amount of people in a tournament. And then on day twos, we've been implementing ID cards. I don't know if you have been accustomed to the ID cards we put on the table. And the ID card is associated with your starting seat, and you are just supposed to keep this with you at all times. And then we can just look at your number, go back to our sheet, and say, okay, 1512 is Dennis Phillips. Mm-hmm. You know, 1513 is Joe Smith. Like, so that way we can track everyone. The only problem with the ID cards is the players tend to lose them sometimes, not bring them with them. They're supposed to keep them with them at all times, right next to their chip stack, invisible. The other day, actually, we had them in the 1500 stud tournament on day two, and one of the players came to me when they were down to maybe three tables, and he was asking me why I busted him. And I was like, okay, well, you know, I don't see your ID card, so that's why. And his ID card was left on his table when he broke a table, and then handed to me by the floor staff. So in turn, I'm like, okay, this guy's out.
There
you
go.
So I busted him. So it's kind of, you know, on the players as well to be able to keep this ID card with them if they want coverage, you know. So
it's tough enough in tournaments that have, you know, relatively small fields of several hundred players. But this weekend they had the first 1500 event. The second 1500 event. It was the first ever re-entry event at WSOP, with nearly 1,700 people on each of day 1 and 1B, making a field of 3,400 that Donnie and the Poker News staff has to keep an eye on in this. By the way, are you surprised at that 3,400 number?
I actually thought it was going to be a little bit higher. I thought it would be around 3,800, maybe reach 4,000. But I was surprised with the day 1B numbers being smaller than I thought. I thought a lot more people would come back, a lot more people would fire two bullets in, and they didn't. But, I mean, numbers overall this year look great this year, and, you know, I'm very impressed with it also.
I absolutely would have. I would have taken a prop bet that it would be over 4,000.
Me too.
I really would have. And absolutely the day 1B would be bigger than 1A. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it was maybe close, but it definitely wasn't any difference.
It was 1696 on 1A and 1708 on day 2 1B. About the same.
Yeah, I was disappointed in the number there too. I thought they'd be bigger. But I don't know. It's still just the first week. You know, there's lots more coming up. Maybe people are pushing it back to the back half of the WSOP.
Who knows? Yeah,
we'll see what happens.
Now, what about the re-entry controversy, which came to light because of Will Fiella being caught, I think at first, by Chris Moorman, because Chris was at the table when Will busted in a rather ugly scenario that we don't have to go into. But then Chris noticed that Will was sitting at another table with nearly a full stack of chips. Tell us what you know about this story, Donnie.
I know that Will played day 1B, busted, and re-entered. And everything that I've come to know about the situation is it's just a mix-up in registration. And I don't think it's at any fault of Will at all. Like Dennis, people that play the circuit events this year, you're allowed to re-enter. And depending on the event and the tournament staff that's there, you can kind of re-enter on the same day. Some days you can play day 1B, bust, but then re-enter before day 2 starts. And it's kind of a little tricky. So you know, Will was probably under the assumption, like, oh, I can just go re-enter. He probably thought, you know, I have two bullets no matter what. If I play day 1A, I play day 1B, whatever, I have two bullets.
Right.
And he went back to registration, you know, but registration should know that, oh, this guy already played, you know, we can't let him back in the tournament type of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if anything's going to come of it. None of the WSOP staff has really told me anything official, so we'll see. I mean,
well,
hopefully.
Here's what we know as of today. 81 people who busted on Sunday, which was day 1B,
yep,
went back and tried to re-register for the event. Three of them, including Will, were given new seats and new stacks before the WSOP caught the mistake, but not before one of those three busted again. One of the three, as I mentioned, was Will. And we know Will. There's Will was trying to cheat,
yeah,
or pull shoot or anything like that. As Donnie said, he probably just thought, I have two bullets. I'm going to fire my second bullet here. And Will, by the way, did tweet, quote, I want to apologize to the poker community. I thought you could rebuy in the first four levels in today's event. I was extremely embarrassed. So Will was taken out of the tournament, and his chips were taken out, and I think he got his money back because it's really registration's fault,
yeah,
that he was allowed back in.
Oh, I think the bottom line is with registration, they should have caught it, period.
For sure.
There's no doubt about
that. Now, there was another tweet from the WSOP later that said, if you can verify you were busted by one of these players through video surveillance, we will issue a refund.
Whoa.
Which is very interesting because I think you have two things here. One, you have the guy who was allowed to re-enter, and he busted, does he get a refund? And
yeah,
does his money stay in the prize pool? And other people who may have been busted by one of these three, and who knows, there could have been others along the way that haven't been caught yet. We don't know. But what do you do with that? Do you leave that money in the prize pool? Do you take it out? Do you give that person another shot? Do you give them their money back? What do you think?
I think you got a dilemma there that there is no right answer to.
Yeah, because then you'd have the people that, you know, what if I lost half my stack to Will?
Yeah.
I didn't get busted, but, you know, I went from 3K to 1,500 in chips.
He did,
I mean,
bust somebody.
He
busted somebody before they pulled him out.
So that person has the right to get their money back, but what about me that lost 50% of my stack, which is still a huge dent to me,
yeah,
and could have screwed up my whole tournament? You
absolutely
know? So now I go to the WSOP and say, hey, you know, Will took half my stack, and they're like, well, you didn't bust. So now it's really a gray area, and it's hard.
Really,
yeah,
a mess.
It's a mess, and I think they've opened a can of worms for that exact scenario you're talking about. Honestly, when they're in there, even if somebody that got back in the tournament when they should have not have and busted somebody else, I don't think they should have opened that door. I'm afraid, you know, there was still cards out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a nice gesture. Oh, we'll give you your money back. I think they were trying to do the right thing. I think they opened a can of worms that it's going to be hard to shut the lid on now.
Now, I should say that if you play the daily deep stacks here at the WSOP, those have unlimited re-entries in their first four levels. So maybe people who had been doing that or had been playing the circuit, as Donnie said,
yep,
thought that this was how it was going to work here as well.
Well, I'm quite sure something like that was going through Will's mind.
Yeah.
There's no way in the world he did this on purpose. He's too well-known player, and he's too... this is Will. It ain't going to happen.
Seth Polansky, who's the communications director for the WSOP, said, if we believe they knew what they were doing and thought they wouldn't get caught, their money would stay in the prize pool and they'd suffer the future consequences. But we don't believe that was their intent. We had 81 people try to re-enter. We don't believe 81 people were trying to cheat. Which sounds right to me.
Absolutely. It wasn't that many people had the misconception of it that wanted to re-enter.
Yeah.
How many others out here thought you could but decided not to? I mean, there had to be hundreds of people that thought you could re-enter it.
Yep.
Period.
Now, one other odd part of this story.
Uh-oh.
There was a guy named Jack Grigsby who it looked like had played twice on Saturday on day 1A. So the WSOP got informed of this, I don't know by whom,
yeah,
and they went and they found out it's Jack Grigsby Sr. and Jack Grigsby Jr. who both played. One of the two made it to day two. I don't know which, whether it was father,
yeah,
or son.
But,
okay. But how about that? Looking down at that. All right, so with Donnie Peters here from Poker News on the Final Table Poker Radio Show, other stories from the first week. Mike Sexton, pretty amazing, two tabling at 64 years old,
yep,
the 3K heads-up pot limit Omaha No Limit Hold'em event, and the $1,500 stud 8 event. Not only that, but finishing 16th in the 3K and 15th in the 1500. That's an unusual thing to have people two-tabling, but it does happen, right?
It does. I think there even is a record that somebody was actually in three tournaments at the same time. A guy by the name of Tom Dwan was in three of them at the same time when he played 52 of the 58 events, which didn't work out too well for him anyhow, but we won't get into that. The fact that I got to tell you a quick story about Phil Ivey, who was doubling, playing two tournaments at once. One of them was heads up, and he comes running into the heads up after having the other guy, his opponent, asking the dealer to deal quick, because he wasn't there. All right. Sets down, five hands into it, busts the guy out, gets up and leave, and the guy's still sitting there going, what just happened to me?
Donnie,
so it can be done.
Explain how difficult this is. For people who are used to playing online and doing multi-screens, that's one thing. You can't. It's not like you're going to the table next door here at the WSOP.
No, and it's especially difficult at the WSOP if your events are in different rooms and you're running, you know, down the hallway, because there's three rooms in play. If you have to play, you know, in multiple rooms on a day one and a day two, you're going to be running across the Rio, which is pretty funny, and you definitely see it. You've seen the Phil Ivies do it this year. Jason Mercier has been doing it. Like you said, Mike Sexton has been doing it. I thought it was awesome that Mike Sexton was doing it, because normally you don't see – you see the younger guys do it, you know, the ones that are supposed to have the energy and be able to run around whatnot. And Mike Sexton was – you know, he was doing it, and he was lively, and he was playing well in both tournaments, so it was great to see.
Yep.
Yeah, and the other thing about it, what Mike was doing it in was a heads-up tournament. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't sit out a round. A round is two hands.
Right.
So, you know, once – and even Mike said, he said, when I went to the heads up, I had to stay there and play it and just hope I didn't lose too many of my chips at the other table.
And as soon as a break – as soon as a break came, right back to the other one.
Yeah, no kidding. You're gone.
Now, speaking of other friends of our show, congratulations to Corey Zeidman, who picked up his first ever bracelet in stud 8. We actually grabbed Corey right after the bracelet ceremony and sat down with him for a half hour or so. Always a fun conversation with him. You'll hear that conversation later on this month. And also a first ever bracelet for the guy who had been called for several years the best player to never win a bracelet, and that is Andy Block.
Yes.
Tell our listeners his story, Donnie.
Well, Andy Block has had numerous final tables. I believe it's 9 or 10 at the WSOP. The first event I actually ever covered for Poker News was in 2008. It was the $10,000 Palom and Hold'em. Andy Block made the final table. He ended up getting heads up with the non-medic, and he couldn't get it done there. And he's had a few runner-up finishes, a third, I believe. And he's always just come so close. And he's always joked, you know, that, hey, I'm the best player without a bracelet. And he's been very light about it, but... I mean, at some, you know, level, it has to resonate with him and be like, you know, hey, I finally got to win one of these. And I was covering this final table, and when he got heads up with Barry Greenstein, if he would have lost, it would have been very devastating because he had a massive chip lead going into heads up play. But the way he was playing and running, I didn't think he was ever going to lose. And it was funny afterwards. He's standing around. He's kind of, you know, waiting for the cameras to come over and whatnot. He's like, I don't know what to do. He kind of didn't, like, he's just kind of looking around, like, so where do I go? Who do I talk to? You know, like.
So he's used to, when it gets down to heads up, when it comes to the winner, he's not that person.
Yeah.
He has to leave.
Yeah. So that was fun. But he was very grateful that he won. And it's great to see such a nice guy and, you know, such a good player.
Here are some stats on Andy. He has played every WSOP since 1995. So this is his 18th World Series of Poker. He has cashed 28 times. He's made 8 final tables in 7 different games. No limit hold'em, limit hold'em, pot limit hold'em, 7 card stud, Raz, pot limit Omaha, and horse. He made a final table the first year that he played. He had 2 second places along the way, including finishing second to Chip Reese in the 50K Poker Players Championship in 2006.
Ooh.
I guess if he had won that, it would be called the Andy Block Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Why does he always pick on the weaker players? Chip and Barry Greenstein.
I know, right?
Why did he get some good competition?
By the way,
when he gets
David Williams
up?
Was third.
Oh, wow.
So I think it's just a great story seeing Andy win this all these years.
I've been lucky enough to play in a lot of different charity events, and every time I sit down at the table, Andy's right across the table from me. It's amazing. He supports it. He's a great ambassador, and I love the idea of him having a bracelet on his wrist.
All right, another story we've got to talk about is another controversy here at the WSOP because of a rule change this year, which Jack Effel mentioned when we had him on when they first announced the schedule back in March. We talked to him about some rule changes, and one of them was a change in the talking rule. It used to be no talking at the table, no talking once you got heads up. You couldn't say anything about your hand. They've loosened that up considerably. They've un-Jamie Golded the WSOP, at least taken away the Jamie Gold rule, which I think is a good thing. But they also instituted a rule that at final tables of bracelet events, you must verbalize your actions. You want to bet, you got to say how much you're betting, or if you're raising, you got to say raise. You can't just put your chips out there. And this has created quite a bit of controversy from players who, well, as Jonathan Aguiar tweeted, some of us have been playing poker in silence for a decade. To expect us to do differently with hundreds of thousands on the line is BS. Now, what's your thought on this as a poker pro, Dennis?
I absolutely agree with him. Allowing the talking, I also agreed with. I thought that the Jamie Gold rule was ridiculous. I think you need to encourage it. I think it's good for the game. I think it's good for TV. The whole bit, like, that's fine. But you can't force people to do it. There is no way in the world you should be forcing them to verbalize all this stuff and to be trying to create the action there or something on it. Sorry, guys, I disagree with you totally on that. You need to allow them to play their game, as he stated so well there. Been playing this for decades, been doing it in silence. Sorry, this is my game. I'm playing for hundreds of thousands. Don't try and change my game.
Donnie, what's your take?
I agree with Dennis. I think that you can suggest it. You can say, hey, players, you know, this is going to be on a live stream. People are watching at home. You know, would you mind verbalizing your bets? But if you make sure the dealer announces every action, then there shouldn't be a problem. You know, if the person does something and the
good
dealer,
point.
You know, you can wait till the final table for the dealer to announce all the action, because normally the dealer's not going to announce everything. But if the dealer says, "Hey, raise to 80,000," you know, re-raise all in, that type of thing, then you know everything's fine. But if the players want to say it, then you know it's good for them. And there was actually an issue with when they brought it up at the stud final table that Andy Block was at. Andy Block thought it was, you know, he didn't want to do it, and Barry Greenstein was kind of on the fence, but he understood why they would ask him to do it. And the players basically said, you know, you can suggest that we do it, you can ask us to do it, but we shouldn't have to do it. And the dealer at the table that was starting actually piped up and said, you know, how about I just announce all the action?
There you
Which,
go.
You know, the tournament staff was like, oh, yeah, okay. Like, that's a good idea.
Now, you said you can understand why you'd want them to do it. Explain why, because I don't get it.
Well, if you're watching at home, I mean, you want to know everything that's going on, you know, especially on a live stream that, you know, you can't see whole cards, you know, you're not, like, super zoomed into the players like you would be when you're watching it later on ESPN. So you want to be able to, you know, hear what the players are doing at all times. So I just think it's good for the people at home to be able to know and be informed at all times what's going on. So if Dennis raises, he just says raise, fine. But if he doesn't say raise, if the dealer says raise, then there's no problem. You know, but if Dennis puts out a bet,
doesn't the dealer always say raise? That's their job.
Not always.
No, not always. many do. Many are very good at it. Not all of them.
Isn't there a tournament director on the floor right there with a microphone in his hand? Isn't that his or her job?
And that, I think that's another way you could have that patched right into the stream as well. But sometimes the tournament directors, you know, they have to go deal with the situation, or they have to go calm down the crowd, or they miss some action, like that's everything. But, you know, that is going to happen as well. So, and the fans at home should know that that's going to happen every once in a while. You're going to miss a hand or whatnot. It's not that big of a deal.
Correct.
But, you know, it's just for if I stick out a bet and nobody says anything, you know, the fans watching at home are like, well, how much did he bet? What's he doing? That type of thing.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, I understood part of the argument here from when Jack told us about this in March was, look, we're doing this for television. Well, ESPN's only covering the main event and one drop. Is there a third event they're doing this year?
Yes, there is. They're covering the Tournament of Champions, the million-dollar free roll.
Oh, the million-dollar national free roll from the circuit. Okay.
Correct.
So those three events, there are 61 events in the World Series of Poker. Now, Dave Tuckman, our friend, is going to be doing streaming coverage of, was scheduled to do streaming coverage of 34 of them with a six-camera setup and pros in the booth with him, and they're always going to do a pretty good job of telling you what's going on. For the non-flop games, like the studs and the Raz and the horse and all that stuff, they're not going to be doing that for every final table. They're just going to have a two-camera setup with nobody announcing the action. So I can see there where you'd want to have the floor person, the tournament director, the dealer, somebody doing that. But the idea of telling players, you have to talk. Dennis, how many times have you talked on this show about verbal tells.
Oh, absolutely. And again, not that he has one, but Phil Hellmuth's famous thing, he covers his mouth and he puts his hand and rests his chin there. If you're forcing him then to uncover and to verbalize, maybe there's a tell there. Don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't want to commit that. But there is so many other things. I have heard people whose voice cracks when they actually talk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've heard all sorts of different things that way. I think
someone
it's wrong.
Like Daniel Negreanu, who always tries to get you to talk.
There you go.
Because he can pick up on, you know, how you're feeling, the way you say something, you know, the way you answer a question or whatnot. Now, if I start saying raise with a squeaky voice, you know, in a spot where I have a huge hand, people are going to pick up on that. So it's a disadvantage to me against some of the better players that know about that stuff. So,
yeah,
you know, it's hard.
Well, any kind of inflection can be read in as a tell. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if you're doing this for an entire final table where I get to sit there for 6 hours to watch everybody else verbalize all of this, I'm going to be looking for tells. I guarantee you that.
So what has the WSOP done? Have they changed the policy?
I believe they've changed the rule now as of last night, I believe.
Are they saying we're going to encourage you to talk, but we're not
going
to?
Yeah, I think, you know, they're suggesting to the players, hey, if you wouldn't mind talking, awesome. It's kind of like, you know, hey, if you wouldn't mind keeping your stacks of chips in 20, awesome. So it's easier to count for everyone. But, you know, not all the players are going to do it.
Did you or your staff catch anybody who'd been penalized for not talking in a final table?
Nope.
Okay. That's good.
Yes, that's good.
That's good. You wouldn't want that.
What I think it is they're just still trying to fine-tune this down. They had the pendulum with the Jamie Gold thing swung all the way over to the left. They took it all the way past the middle over to the right. Now they're bringing it back down to a more reasonable interpretation of what should happen there at the final table.
Donnie, thanks for coming by. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Right, Donnie Peters from Poker News here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris and our continuing coverage of the 2012 World Series of Poker. On 590 of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast available via FinalTableShow.com and downloadable via iTunes and Stitcher Radio.